Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you with us. And welcome here to Soundbites, our weekly program looking at the future of our food system. And you're listening to Soundbites here on WEAA-FM, celebrating 88 days of summer. Details at WEAA.org and on Delmarva Public Radio on WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And we start our program off. We're going to be talking with Lucy Snodgrass in just a moment about her editorial on immigration in rural Maryland. We'll be talking with Arthur Morgan about work feeding the hungry here in Baltimore, Maryland, where we're broadcasting from today. And they'll have a long conversation about bees, why they're important to us, why they're collapsing, and what pesticides and fungicides have to do with that. And Lucy Snodgrass, welcome. Good to have you in the studio with us.
Great to be here, Mark. Thanks.
Lucy Snodgrass is the Maryland State Executive Director of the USDA's Farm Service Agency. She wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun. It was called Rural Maryland Needs Immigration Reform. You can go to steinershow.org and look at that as we're talking with her as well. And it's interesting that this happened. This is when we think of immigration reform, we think of people wanting to have people come to America who come from some South Asian countries to bolster technology industries, as some people would argue.
Sure.
You're arguing in this editorial, this immigration reform deeply affects the nation's, but it's Maryland's agricultural economy, right?
It does. It affects actually everybody in America. I think the reality is no one wants to look at the fact that we are hugely dependent on foreign labor to pick our crops, milk our cows, pluck our chickens, do all those kinds of things. People want to eat. You need to realize the fact that without an immigration bill, a lot of our food sources are really, you know, could be called into question with the labor market.
So what do you mean they'd be called into question? If things continue the way they are, let's say there was no immigration reform. We'll talk about in a moment how you think immigration reform affects agriculture here in the state of Maryland especially.
Sure.
But supposing it didn't exist,
well,
what difference would it make to the consumer? Start there.
Well, we estimate that about 1.1 million of the 11 million undocumented people living in this country are working in the agricultural sector. There's a lot of wink, wink, nod, nod that goes on now where people look the other way, knowing full well that most of the workers out in the fields are, in fact, not legally here. But because it's such a vital source of everybody's nutrition and our economy. Let's not forget that the American agricultural export sector is one of the strongest for this country. It's been one of the things that's kept us going in the recession. So if they crack down, we would lose a lot of people who are actually here working and have been for quite some time. So there's that potential that we really could be faced with a lot fewer workers, which would force companies to shrink, take on less work, not expand, and potentially more work could actually go abroad.
So how does it affect, let's say, farms on Delmarva? How does it affect the farms that exist in the Eastern Shore?
It affects farmers all across the state. So let's look at a couple of sectors. The dairy industry, for example, a lot of the folks milking,
which is mostly in Western Maryland.
Right.
So a little bit on the Eastern Shore, but mostly in Western
Maryland.
Mostly
Western Maryland and Central Maryland. On the shore, you've got poultry workers. You've got also crab pickers, although they're affected by a slightly different visa program. But and then you've got folks who are working in picking watermelons, you know, cantaloupes, fresh fruits and vegetables that are coming to the markets and things. Mostly foreign labor picking that.
So, but there, I mean, clearly a lot of farmers wanted to see this reform because they don't want to lose the workers that they have to pick the crops and grab the chickens.
Right.
That are ubiquitous on all the CAFOs across the Eastern Shore.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of political opposition to this.
There is. You know, and I think one of the reasons the Secretary of Agriculture has really encouraged us all to try and get this message out is that I think we're hypocritical to some extent if we want to not look at where the food that we're eating is being picked and coming from. You know, I think we're kidding ourselves. We have to actually look at the fact that it's a reality that we have probably a million people working in the agricultural sector, and they're here illegally. We have to do something about it. It's not fair to our farmers who rely on farming as their livelihood. They need to know that they have a steady labor force. And most American-born people do not want to be out working and doing this kind of labor, we found.
Well, a couple of people have raised some issues here when it comes to whether it's here in Maryland or across the country, to also the exploitation of people who are undocumented. Because if you're an undocumented worker, you can't take your employer to court.
That's right.
You can't even walk into the courtroom because you don't have the proper ID. You can't get in the door.
Yeah.
And that's a huge issue. It has to do with wages. I mean, this could – well, let's just stop there.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that I think is so beneficial in the Senate's immigration bill is that it does create an actual pathway to citizenship, and it creates a new visa program for farm workers. And that would allow people to be on the record, registered. We'd work with the farmers who need the labor, and that would be carefully monitored. So that's good for the laborers. It gives them more rights because they are registered and they have some recourse if they have problems. And it's better for the farmers because they know that they've got a legal way of bringing labor onto their farms.
So we've had the Immokalee workers on the show a number of times from Florida. They're very close to some organizations in the state of Maryland. How does this affect the right of farm workers to organize, farm workers to talk about the condition, their working conditions and more?
It would not affect them adversely at all. If anything, I think it would strengthen their ability to say, we are a force here that needs to be reckoned with and dealt with. And we are actually not invisible. We are here.
I mean, I know we've talked to a lot of people who raise chickens here on the shore. And we know that the company, when Purdue and others come in with the chicken catchers to catch the chickens, mm-hmm. which is a job that was mostly Afro-American men who had that job. They still have the job, but the majority of those workers are now immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's also been, how do you think that affects that? I mean, there's been a divide here often that people try to overcome. How do you think that affects all of that interaction?
You know, I think it goes to a much larger question of what are we paying people who are doing that kind of work?
Right.
And, you know, I think that's something for this country and the Congress to consider is that we need to pay people actually better than we are paying them. When you continue to pay people very, very low wages, all you're doing then is having people who are at the absolute bottom compete against each other. And that encourages black market labor, and it just is not – it's not good for anybody in the system.
So how do you see the law right now change – what's it going to do to change the lives of the farmers who were just on the show 2 weeks ago who raise everything from corn to soy to chickens? How's it going to change their existence?
It may not change those farmers' existence exactly, but it would, for example, for somebody who's now relying on a fair amount of this immigrant labor. Let's say there was a crackdown and all of their laborers were then – taken and deported. That's going to affect them considerably. Under the legislation that the Senate passed, they would actually now know that they could work with USDA to get legally permitted
laborers.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And in turn, if they worked for 5 years in the agricultural sector, paid any past taxes, paid fines, whatever, they'd have a legal path to citizenship.
So when is this implemented? How do you see this thing? I mean, there's this political opposition. I mean, you know, you've gotten some feedback from this article, from your op-ed, from folks who think that this should not be happening because we're encouraging illegal immigration mm-hmm. of undocumented people. So I'm curious, where does this go from here? What literally is going to happen?
Well, as you know, the Senate passed the bill. The House has yet to act on it. They're coming back after the Labor Day recess. And I hope, and this is one of the reasons, you know, I did this and others across the country in my position are doing it as well, is to call attention to this issue. We need an immigration reform bill. There's just no two ways about it. We can continue to pretend that it's not a problem, that we have millions of people who are here working and living and raising families, or we can actually say, let's be courageous and try and deal with this in a common sense way. That's what the Senate has done. The House needs to do the same thing now.
So I know that you're not – I mean, you're a federal employee, so you can't take political sides. I'm not asking you to do that at all. But I'm curious what you know about where our congressional delegation stands on this. I mean, whether it's Andy Harris in Eastern Shore, Elijah Cummings represents farmland out in Baltimore County, the representatives who represent Western Maryland, where do we –
Again, yes, I want to be very careful, but
for what I
understand is most of our delegation would be supportive of the Senate's bill.
Most, which means not all, probably.
That's probably right.
We'll have to get them on the air to talk about who's there and who's not, because most of the people who we interview in the agricultural world here on Soundbites, especially the farmers, whether they are the quote unquote new farmers or old traditional farmers. Being a farmer means you're naturally conservative. This is a natural bent you have when you're a farmer, which makes a great deal of sense. On the other hand, most people in agriculture, no matter what way they vote, want to see this bill passed.
They do, because they're business people. You know, farmers are the ultimate small business people. And our country, the vast majority of the people in our country are small businesses in some way, affiliated with small businesses in some way. It's the backbone of our economy. And so we're denying them, I think, a really safe way to run their businesses and feel like they don't have to look over their shoulder every couple of minutes and see if INS is coming to deport people.
So which can still happen today because it's not a law now.
No.
So before we let you go, Lucy Snodgrass, just what is what does the Farm Service Agency do?
It's good that you ask. We're one of USDA's.
Just who are you?
We're one of USDA's agencies.
United States Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we have 21 offices in the state of Maryland. We do everything from give loans to farmers, below interest rate loans. So we're really the lender of first opportunity for farmers who have trouble getting credit, for example. We also run the commodity payment programs, which probably will be phased out. And we run conservation programs. So if a farmer wants to take some of his or her land out of production and put in some buffer strips for conservation purposes, we administer those programs. So we also do disaster relief. If the state is declared a disaster area and we've got a bunch of counties that were affected, we then make sure that the farmer gets the disaster money to help him on relief.
Well, we'll follow this. I think what we should follow up with as soon as Congress comes back in session is to get some of our congressional representatives on both sides of this issue on this here and debate this out and talk to our farmers and debate this out. I think that it's how this is our first conversation about immigration reform and the future of agriculture because Lucy Snodgrass, who is the executive director of the Farm Service Bureau for the federal government here in Maryland, wrote the editorial, Rural Maryland Needs Immigration Reform. This is our launch to discuss this conversation. We're going to come back and discuss this over the coming weeks with farmers, with political leaders across the state of Maryland, especially on the shore, here on the shore, and debate it out so you all can see what's going on and let your representatives know what you think. And Lucy Snodgrass, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio for the first time. Now that we know that you're now the head of the Farm Service Bureau Agency, we're going to have you more.
Thanks,
and
Mark.
Talk more about the future of agriculture in our state.
Well, that's great. I really welcome this discussion.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
We're going to take a brief break, and Arthur Morgan, founder of Gather Baltimore, joins us to talk before we look at the future of bees and why they're so important, not just for agriculture, but for our future. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show. Of course, this is Soundbites, our weekly look at the future of agriculture in the state of Maryland, future of our food system that we broadcast here on WEAA-FM, 88.9 FM out of Baltimore, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM out of Salisbury, Maryland. We are now joined by Arthur Morgan, who is currently an OSI Baltimore Community Fellow, founder of Gather Baltimore, a volunteer-based program that collects and greens fresh produce donated by farmers markets and farms for distribution to people without healthy food sources. And what we're learning is that one out of six people At least one out
more
of
than
six
that.
People, more than that.
More than that.
One out of five, some people argue, yeah. of people in the state of Maryland live with food scarcity. We are in the process now of doing a series that our producers are out collecting data in and stories in Cambridge, Maryland, in Baltimore, Maryland, and Cumberland, Maryland about food scarcity in people's lives, which we'll be broadcasting here on Sound Bites in the coming months. And Arthur Morgan, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to
have you
here.
That's the very first thing I wanted to do. I wanted to thank you because you've let me come on the show more than once. It's like you keep up with what's going on, and it has helped me a lot as far as getting the word out and getting volunteers and getting people to help and asking what's going on. So I wanted to say thank you to you and your staff.
It's our pleasure to have you here. So, Arthur, when I was making the introduction just then, you were kind of said more than that. What do you say? What do you mean?
More than that. And I wrote on my hand right here. This is something that we're doing where we're going in the neighborhoods and we're setting up our farm stands. We're capturing all the excess food from farmers markets. I'm going to some of the distribution centers like out in Jessup and capturing food, and I'm barely getting what's actually there. And especially the food that's in the fields that the farmers can't even get to. But we usually start our farm stand giveaway at about 1 to 1:30. But at 10:15, when I go to drop off the first load of food, there are already people standing in line just to get a bag of food. And this is an Oliver neighborhood.
It's Oliver, east side of Baltimore.
Yes, sir, right off of Broadway. Yeah. And that's actually a fairly decent neighborhood. You know, there's a lot of good things going on there. They're rebuilding houses. They're trying to address these food issues. There's people that are invested. And there are so many other neighborhoods that are so much worse than that. But there is nothing. There is no food. There's no access. But there is food, you know, whether it's at the farms that are right outside of the city or at all these big areas like Jessup and things like that. So there is food, but these people just are not – they just don't have access to it. But something's wrong if you're standing in line at 2 to 3 hours before the food's even being given away just for a bag of food.
People are waiting for the food you deliver 2-3 hours before you get there.
10:15. I wrote it on my hand. I took pictures last Sunday at 10:15. I was going by to unload the first load at the stand because I usually have some stuff from Jessup that I unload. They sort and put out, and then I go down to the farmer's market, the Sunday farmer's market, and get another truckload of food. And then we come back about 1 to 1:30 and start bagging it and distributing it to members of the community. Also, we've let other people know they can show up to get the food. But it just really grabbed me Sunday when I'm seeing people there. You know, that's actually 3 hours before that just to get some corn and some grapes and some oranges. So and we're trying to talk to people and ask them, you know, what is it that they need? You know, what's going on? You know, what more can we do? So I mean, this helps a lot. I just, you know, I say to you always, you know, we're always looking for volunteers. We're trying to spread the word about what's going on. We're looking for more community groups that can receive this food and help distribute the food. So this helps a lot just by talking about it. But there's more that can be done.
So tell me what is happening now. Obviously, something brings you to the studio today very specifically, right?
Something I wanted to be so thankful for is last year, this is how much we've come in just a year. You know, last year, before I got my fellowship, we were basically just going to the farmer's market, and I had my Suburban. I'd call a couple buddies, and, you know, we'd have some pickup trucks, and we'd load up some food. So from less than a year, we've gone from just a couple guys getting together to grab the food to Coastal Sunbelt donated a refrigeration truck. We're still working on refrigeration space to store a lot of this food, but we've gone from, you know, getting a small amount of food from a farmer's market to every week 10 to 15,000 pounds of food that we're touching and getting it to the people. But what we're seeing is there needs to be more distribution points. There needs to be more people gathering food. There needs to be more refrigeration trucks. So we've gone from, you know, a couple thousand pounds to total, we're between 300,000 and 400,000 pounds so far, at least, that we've gathered and distributed. Wow. And that is just touching what's there. I mean,
you're saying that's barely touching the surface of what people need.
That's nothing. It's nothing. Yeah, that's just in Baltimore, you know? I mean, how many people are living in inner city areas who just either do not have access to this food or do not know what to do with this food or just have really limited income You know, you always hear that people have, you know, money or food stamps or they are able to buy groceries, but usually by the third week, you know, all the money's gone. And for the last week, you know, they're waiting for another check or stamps, and there's people are hungry.
So, folks, you can join us here, by the way, at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk to Arthur Morgan about Gather Baltimore. So, I mean, how many neighborhoods could you really
We could touch them all. I mean, we really could. I mean, you look at how many farms are around Baltimore City and how much excess food there is there, how many distributors are in Jessup. And it's just a fact. These people are going to throw the food away. And they actually have to pay to have that food hauled away. They have to pay the drivers. They have to pay dump fees. They have to pay for dumpsters. So they're paying to throw food away that normally, you know, it still has shelf life. It's still good, but they're waiting for that next, the fresher stuff to come in. You know, it's I can't even put it into words how much food I've been into a warehouse the size of a football field of tomatoes. And, you know, the food's there. And that's something I'm trying to concentrate on the months that we're not farming. But I really want to focus on the local farmers, the area farmers, you know, getting that food because they need, they're growing the food. You know, they have the ability to get the food to us if they would just have some help. You know, I need volunteers so bad. I mean, I could go two or three times a week out to any field and just get thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of corn, tomatoes, eggplants, you know, fresh food that is healthy. It is affordable, too. I mean, that's just another thing.
And right now you're just doing an olive community, but you could expand that.
I could. I really could. If I had help, you know, if I could work with the right people, you know, I'm looking at what we're doing now, and I'm excited. I'm not disappointed, but I'm also it's upsetting when you see what else needs to be done. And everybody talks and talks and talks and talks, but I don't see a lot of people really doing what needs to be done.
So how can people get to you to figure out how to help you?
Facebook. Uh-huh. There we go. Facebook, Gather Baltimore.
Gather Baltimore on Facebook.
Yeah,
right.
That helps. That really, you can see what's going on. We're always needing volunteers. We have a campaign going on GiveCorps, which really helps because we're definitely trying to get refrigeration space. GatherBaltimore@gmail.com and also our webpage. And I'm just reaching out, and I really appreciate you let me back in here. Hopefully maybe one day we can do something live where you come out and you can see, you know, we can do a broadcast from the fields. We can get some people to come and actually see this, maybe get some people from the city who are making these decisions to get their butts out there in the field and see what's available and work with the farmers more. You know, the farmers are very limited in how much they can afford to do as far as pay labor to do the markets and what they can do. But if we could figure out some type of system where I could be working with more volunteer groups, school groups, you know, prisons, anything. I just need manpower to get this food.
And vehicles to pick it up.
Yep, absolutely. And points of distribution where people in those neighborhoods can set up a stand and have things controlled to where things are distributed in an orderly manner and people are getting the food who really need the food.
So if neighborhood organizations came to you and said, we have a place to distribute the food that you can gather. You work with the neighbor organizations to do that.
Yes, sir. And let them kind of take over and work and know within the neighborhood. It's hard for me to go into a neighborhood and tell people what to do. You know, I can get the food and get it to them, but they need to work within their community to get it to the people who really need. And something I haven't touched on, but I really want to spend more time and energy on, is actually getting the food to people who are homebound, who have no way of even getting out of their house and getting to these stands. I feel like we need help, you know, getting food and bag it up and getting it to their doors. You know, that there's a whole nother group of people that we're not even talking about that really, really need this food. So all I can say is we've come a long way in a year, but we've got a long ways to go, but it's very doable, and we just need to get the right people together to actually work together instead of just sitting around talking about it, because there is a solution. It's affordable, it's healthy, and it helps everybody.
Well, we'll do everything we can to keep
and
connecting this, because I think as we go out to communities talking to people and what's going on with their food banks, other things that are taking place, those are the kind of folks you need to be connected to.
Yes, sir.
And they can connect with each other. And folks who have the trucks and they can get out there and pick up the food to have it delivered.
And the volunteers and people who are just looking for stuff to do and people who want to see that there is food being grown around here. And, you know, a lot of people haven't seen farms or realize how food is grown and how it's cooked and what you do with it. So there's a lot of people who can come together and work on this project to help each other. And a lot of people can benefit from it. And, you know, we talk about health care, disease, and all these other issues that we're touching. There's just food is so important in everyday life.
Once again, Arthur Morgan, it's always great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Go to the Facebook page, Gather Baltimore. You can link right there to all the stuff you need and to get in touch with Arthur Morgan, get your neighborhood involved.
Volunteer,
help him gather this food. He gets 400,000 pounds of food a year.
And More than that.
Feeding a lot of people. So, Arthur Morgan, thank you for your work.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate it very much.
We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back here on the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites, we're going to – there's a phone call here, but it's about you. Hold on. We'll let Arthur take it around the corner and get information for him. We're going to take a brief break and come right back and talk about bees. Why are they dying off? Why are they important? Stay with us.
Thank you. I should have brought you.
Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites here on WEAA FM 88.9 here out of Baltimore throughout the state of Maryland and Marvel Public Radio in Salisbury, Maryland, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. A report came out partially from the University of Maryland looking at what is happening to our bees and why the population is falling so fast. And as a tweet we got this morning said from Eastern Maryland, do you like almonds, broccoli, apples? Honeybee populations are dwindling. Without them, you can say goodbye to them. So we are going to focus on that for this next half an hour to look at what is happening to our bee population, why is it important, and what this report said. We are here with Dr. Jeff Pettis, research leader with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Center's Bee Research Laboratory, co-author of the recently released report we talked about called On Honeybees, Pesticides, Fungicides, and Crop Pollination. Steve McDaniel's in the studio. He's a master beekeeper with 35 years' experience, past president of the Maryland State Beekeepers Association, who teaches a course in beekeeping at the Irvine Nature Center. And Mimi Thomas is with us, who is director of Baltimore Honey, a nonprofit organization that works to maximize local honeybee pollination coverage for local food security, maker of Bee More Honey brand raw micro local honey.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to have you all with us.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to be here.
And join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page or tweet us at Mark Steiner, as the people did from Easton, who we just read their tweet. So join us here, 410-319-8888. So let me start with you, Dr. Pettis, about this report, which I think is clearly a really important report that came out. It really struck my attention a couple of weeks ago when I first read about it and started reading it. And when you say you detected 35 pesticides and sample pollen found high fungicide loads, talk about what that means and what this report says.
Sure. So the report, we looked at, we put honeybee colonies on several different crops that they would normally pollinate and captured the pollen that was coming in off those crops or off the vegetation around those crops. And then we looked at it for pesticide load, looked at for 170 different pesticides, And again, we detected 35 distinct pesticides. And I think on average, each of the pollen loads would have about 9 pesticides. So what it kind of points out that bees are getting a variety of exposures to things like, you know, insecticides and fungicides. And we show in the paper that fungicides in this case were problematic in that they could cause an increase in a gut pathogen. The gut pathogen's name is Nosema. It's a gut pathogen that affects adult honeybees. So, again, we're doing real-world exposure levels and trying to understand what those might mean for bee health.
So now, just for our listeners and for all of us, fungicide, pesticide, what are we talking about and what's the difference?
Sure. So pesticide is the broad term. It means anything that would kill a pest, and a pest could be things like fungi or bacteria. And so if it's targeted fungi, it'd be a fungicide, and those are usually sprayed on crops to protect the bloom from rot or things like that. That's a fungicide. An insecticide would be something targeting insects in particular, and you have other things like herbicides targeting plants. So there's a variety of pesticides, and they fall into various categories depending on what they're trying to kill.
And when we're looking at these things, and I'll let us jump in here, that we're not talking, I mean, with this death of millions and millions of bees, we're not talking about just stuff that farmers use on crops. In fact, we're talking about a great deal more than that.
Sure. I mean, there's if we did a broad survey a few years back in conjunction with Penn State and showed that the beehive is a, if you will, a great sink for a lot of materials. They go out and forage in the environment. They pick up everything that's out there. It gets kind of tied up in the wax or the bees themselves and sometimes in the pollen. And some of those things are some things that beekeepers might use to try to control parasitic mites in the colony. So there's a lot of different chemicals, not all of which are pesticides, that the bees can be exposed to.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. And I want to explore for a minute about what this report, come back to what this report says, but in the context of why this is important. You know, people, you know, we think of bees, most people think of bees, or we think of something with a stinger that we have to run away from. If you're not, like, raising bees or into farming, you don't think much about bees being friendly. You just dash away from them like you would a wasp.
We play with them.
Oh, I'm sure you do, but the rest of us don't play with them. So,
I think you touched on it when you mentioned the word food security. I mean, it sounds rather dire that honeybee health or pollinator health is at the basis of meeting our food security needs. But it is in large part because the things that they bring to our table are the fruits, nuts, and vegetables, which kind of enrich our diet. They really add a lot of valuable nutrients to our diet, as opposed to the wind-pollinated things, which are corn, rice, and wheat. We can get by on that, but we're not going to thrive on things that are wind-pollinated.
And you were about to say what, Steve?
Just that we enjoy having our bees and keep them in our backyards, our front yards. And they don't bother the neighbors. People think that they're going to get stung by bees, but what they get stung by are mostly yellow jackets. And the yellow jackets are wasps that actually eat bees. So they get stung by a yellow jacket and say, oh, I was stung by a bee. But that's kind of like confusing the bunny rabbit with the wolf.
But let's talk about that, and I'll show you why this is important.
Well, talking about food security.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's not just food security for us as humans, but also wildlife and our water quality. Honeybees pollinate trees, which produce the leaves, which slow down rain from entering into the ground to create sediment runoff into the Chesapeake Bay. So they also produce grains and fruits and nuts for our wildlife. Yes, we think about ourselves, you know, as far as food security, but it's also not just the aesthetics of our environment, but also the network of including all things that are living into the food security system.
So, I mean, I read a report the other day about China, which in certain sections of China, they've lost all the bees that exist.
Right.
So they've not only hurt their agriculture, they now have to pollinate each plant artificially in order to grow food sources. And one of the things that I just give you a sense of what we're talking about here, Time magazine had an article about this in this latest issue of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. And they talked about a Whole Foods in Rhode Island that did a campaign to highlight the importance of honeybees. And they temporarily removed from the produce section all of the food dependent on pollination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So of the 453 items that they put on their shelves every day, when they did this experiment, 237 of those items vanished.
True.
Including apples, lemons, squashes, zucchini, and many of the things, grapes, anything that you take for granted just to pick up and buy at a store, would not exist without bees. So let's talk for a moment with what is the extent as we know it of the destruction of bee populations in this country?
It's been devastating. This past year, statewide average across Maryland, according to the Department of Agriculture, 70% loss. Now, that's like having
of the honeybee population.
That's of colonies. That doesn't count the ones that are have lost half their population, but the colony is still alive. So this is like having 70% of the cattle drop dead in 1 year. And this is a major, major problem. There isn't a clear-cut cause. There are multiple causes. But one that I've come up with is probably this one that I've brought you a show and tell for the radio.
A rose and flower care.
It's a systemic pesticide, insecticide, that goes on your flowers. And it's absorbed through through the roots and goes through all parts of the plant, including the nectar and pollen. What it does is poison the nectar sources, the food sources for pollinators. So bees, honeybees, bumblebees, all the native bees, butterflies as well are in serious decline, and I think this is one of the causes.
Now, Jeff Pettis, one of the things there are a couple of things to raise here. One of the things with this massive loss of bees and how it can affect our agricultural system, the stuff we put on our lawns and our gardens have an effect. So if a bee is pollinating whatever it's pollinating in for apple orchards and more, the role that's played by the insecticides and fungicides we put in our lawns have a lot to do with why you're saying you're saying probably has a lot to do with why there's this bee loss. Correct?
Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking to Jeff.
I was talking to Jeff.
Yeah,
but you want to start, Jeff? And go
well,
to
Jeff is dealing mostly with agricultural applications,
right.
But that doesn't explain the loss in Baltimore City last year, which was catastrophic. Now, Mimi's Bee said she's had relatively little loss. Most of the other beekeepers I've talked to have lost – they've only had two or three colonies. But they've lost two out of two or two out of three, and it's been devastating. And it's 10 miles from the nearest farm, so it can't be agriculturally based.
Yeah.
Because most bees work in live in a five-mile radius.
A mile or two. I don't think they usually go 5 miles.
Okay.
They'd be pretty desperate for that. Yeah, yeah. Out in the desert, they might go five miles if they had to.
One of the things that we encourage when we place our honeybee hives on hive host properties, individuals, residential, businesses, schools, whatever they might be as far as a hive host, that they have to reach out to their adjacent property owners, whether it be a neighbors or businesses, and then have them sign off on a pledge that they will not use chemicals, that they would be supportive of them being a hive host, their neighbor. So we create this network of lots, properties, that is omitting the use of all these chemicals and herbicides, fungicides, pesticides, whatever it might be, outdoors. Even to the extent of being careful of how they apply the mosquito repellent, you know, on themselves outdoors. So in addition to that, this network creates another network, a patchwork quilt. So we then protect our honeybees as best as we can by also asking our hive hosts to plant pollinator plants in support of the food. So,
Jeff, go ahead.
So, Mimi, if I can jump in, I think even on the national level, the things that we're going to do to solve some of this are going to happen on the local level. I mean, it's going to take local effort. And what Mimi was describing is a great example of that. And we have to consider how far the bees fly. But Steve was right. I mean, in an urban setting, it's probably they're not being exposed to ag chemicals, certainly, but they are being exposed to things that the homeowner might use. And the label rate for those things by homeowners is much higher than the farmer uses. So there is some concern there that if you look at whatever you're using in your garden, the rate that you're applying is much higher than what the farmer is applying. So that's of concern. But I do think there's a big effort out there now, locally and even nationally, to try to increase diverse forage out there for all pollinators, not just not just bees, things like bats, birds, and butterflies. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that add pollination. And the other comment I wanted to quickly make was that you always want to lead the nation in something, but this 70% for Maryland loss last year, you don't want to lead in that category.
No.
It's nationwide. We've been losing for the past 7 years about 30 to 33% of the managed honeybee colonies. Maryland's rate goes up and down, but this past year in Maryland, it was particularly bad at 70%. Nationwide last year, we lost 31%. So it's a concern, but I think some of the solutions start in our own backyard.
Yeah.
So why do you all think, let me start with you, Jeff, just since you wrote the study and then go around the room very quickly, why do you think that it's so high in the state of Maryland? What is it about? What are we doing here?
Good question. I mean, if people usually, and I'm from the Department of Ag, usually people point to ag use of pesticides. Well, that's mostly Eastern Shore. That's mostly Eastern Shore of Maryland. And I think the losses across the state were broad. They were in all areas. And like Steve pointed out, what's happening in downtown Baltimore? I think a lot of it, there's a strong nutritional component to this where the bees aren't finding sufficient forage. We're turning our houses into, mm-hmm. These pristine lawns, or we're turning areas into, we plant plants in urban settings that aren't particularly good for wildlife. They're maybe aesthetically pleasing. Bradford pear is a great example. I mean, those of you in the horticulture industry, that's a useless tree. I mean, it looks good for a few years and it's gone. So anyway, I think we can do a lot in providing better habitat for all kinds of wildlife.
And then you also have to deal with it on the Delmarva Peninsula here, where we broadcast sound bites,
yeah.
is the monoculture, where mm-hmm. it leaves, because those the soy and corn do not need to be pollinated by bees, and that
right.
plays there's a huge factor in. In that, that's probably high in places like Iowa as well, as I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, we call them some kind of a desert. And it was basically, if you have nothing but corn and soybeans and very little in the ditches or surrounding areas, there's not much for any pollinator to feed upon.
Maryland's number one crop is turf grass. 877,000 acres are covered in turf grass. Of that, 70% are homeowners. And that came from the Turf Grass Industry Survey recently. In Baltimore, 136,456 acres are in turf. In Baltimore alone, Montgomery County is the number one with 140,000 acres in turf.
I thought it would be Howard County.
Well, Howard County comes in 66,000.
So tear up your lawns, grow flowers and vegetables. That's
And don't poison them.
Leave
the clover growing.
And the
dandelions.
Well, see, clover and dandelion is what we kill when we throw insecticide.
Exactly.
And pesticides. Herbicides, I should say, over our lawns, which is where the bees go to.
Sure.
And the nectar is their carbohydrate source, and the dandelion is their protein source.
So let me ask you this question, because you were one of the things in this. Let me take two things from this Time article. One was a quote they gave to you, Jeff Pettis. The take home message is that we are very close to the edge. It's a roll of the dice now.
Right.
And at the end of the article, the author of the article writes, but just says, plight of the bees illustrates our outsized influence, human beings, mm-hmm. on this planet as we reshape it, consciously and not, to meet our immediate needs. But just because we have this power doesn't mean we fully understand it or our impact on our own world. We are a species that increasingly has omnipotence without omniscience. That's a dangerous combination for animals and plants that we share the planet that share the planet with us. And eventually, it will be dangerous for us, too.
Sure.
Let's wrestle with that for a minute, starting with you, Jeff, since I started with your quote.
Well, so what I was referring to there mostly is just our ability to meet commercial pollination needs. So I was focused on the agricultural pollination needs, and we barely met it last year in almonds. And I think part of that is driven by our desire and also our demand for cheap food, but also what we call perfect food. We don't necessarily need perfect food. We need to be able to live with something that's not, aesthetically perfect. So I think cheap food is driven some of what's happening in agriculture recently. And so I think that is, and we do tend to be human-centric. I guess really quickly, I'd like to touch back on the homeowner and the lawns and that kind of thing. If we went back and in, let's say, a one-acre lawn setting, and you just put aside 25% or even 50% of that into trees and shrubs, you'd go a long way. You still can have that small patch of very perfect lawn that you want to have a picnic on, but just take a proportion of that and put it back into native vegetation. We'd go a long way towards solving some of these issues.
The trees are wonderful for that because they go up. Yeah. You don't need a lot of space at the, on the ground level to have a large number of flowers. A tulip poplar tree can feed a beehive.
An indigenous tree, by the way.
Yes, a native tree.
Right. So I mean, what do you see as a solution? I mean, one of the things we're reading in this article is that they're trying to create robot bees to do the pollination.
Oh well, that's nonsense.
Well, yeah. but clearly, the technology sees we have a problem, so that's how people want to fix it. But how do we fix it then?
We need to get all of those chemicals off of the retail shelves.
Exactly.
That's what we need to do, because even though they're on there and there's a lot of educated people who purchase it, they don't read the label or they don't, you know, understand the label. They think more is better, and or else if it sits down in their basement, they just get rid of it and ends up somewhere else. Those are loaded guns, so to say, that are sitting on the shelves, not only for the honeybee, but for also our food system and food security. And we need to get them off the shelves.
But yes, Mimi, this stuff, you mentioned the label. This is deadly to bees. 20 parts per billion in the food is enough to kill bees.
What do you mean, 20 parts per billion?
This is very, very, very dilute. I mean, almost so dilute that it can't be measured in the laboratory. And Jeff will tell you that the minimum amount you can measure is 1 to 5 parts per billion, and only a little bit more than that is enough to kill bees. And there is not one word on the label of this product, this right. Bare advanced systemic
rose and flower care.
Rose and flower care.
Feeds and protects in one easy step.
It does. It makes your roses look great because nothing can eat them. The aphids and Japanese beetles die, but so do all the pollinators. And it's not just bees. It's butterflies and other pollinators. So this stuff definitely should be taken off the market. They're promoting it to homeowners as being safe for bees, which is an outright lie.
And the other thing is also neem-based oils. You know, neem is considered an organic herbicide, organic fungicide, insecticide, pesticide. And a lot of apple orchards spray the neem-based inert or direct ingredient on their apples and their leaves. And what happens is that neem oil base, which is considered organic, stops the pupa from going into the metamorphosis stage, which allows the honeybee to develop to be a honeybee. So you can look in your hive and see beautiful cap brood, but nothing's coming, and your colony's decreasing.
One can only hope that the pesticides working group in the State House in Annapolis is actually reading some of these reports and reading your reports, Jeff Bettis. So I'm curious, just some closing thoughts here. Because the Time author added that banning these chemicals is still only one piece of the puzzle. He said the monoculture, pesticides, and more, Jeff, are like it's a very complex web that we have woven in this country.
Right. I guess I'd like to talk about two different fronts. One is, the issue of pesticides, pesticide exposure, and label rates and things like that, which I think definitely needs to be addressed. And I think certain places we're addressing it in a reasonable manner. Other places, maybe we need to step up those efforts. And I know there's differing opinions on that. But the other is one effort that we are doing that I think is very positive is this idea of just increasing habitat and increasing nutrition out there, either in the ag setting or homeowner setting. So I think that's a very positive thing that everybody can look to as being something that they could do to make a difference. I'll take my own backyard vegetable garden as a good example. If you plant eight different crops this year, and all of a sudden you see some pests coming into one particular crop, well, maybe that year you don't get any squash, or maybe that year you don't get any whatever it is. We can't tend to over-medicate for everything. We medicate ourselves, and we over-medicate our gardens and our flowers. So what if it gets downy mildew or powdery mildew this year? You know, let it go. Let it go through a natural cycle. And so I think there's a sense that we need to maybe treat less in all settings, and that would help on the pesticide side. And I guess on the nutrition side, there's some efforts with National Resource Conservation Service and others to trying to get diversity back out into the landscape, and I think that'll help a great deal. So I guess I'm optimistic, but we do need to have a change in attitude towards things like our backyards and our lawns, and also just in the demand that we have for food production and creating perfect food.
We only have like a couple of minutes left in this segment.
We really need our backyard beekeepers. I mean, people like us don't take our bees to California to pollinate the almonds. We pollinate everything in the neighborhood. If you plant cucumbers and you don't get any cucumbers, it's probably because there aren't enough bees in the neighborhood. So beekeepers perform a service in their area, which can extend a mile or more from where the hives are actually located.
Well, there are no pesticides in our garden, and my wife is
good
the gardener.
You.
So and we do have lots of bees, lots
good.
Of butterflies, lots of cucumbers, lots of tomatoes.
Great.
May not be pretty-looking cucumbers and tomatoes, but they really taste good.
That's what counts.
So I do want to thank you all for being here. I think this is an important discussion to have, and I didn't mean to end it on levity, really, because I think that is a very serious, critical issue we're facing in the future of our food system and agriculture, and bees. We have to take this very seriously, and we'll come back to this subject. And when we come back to our next conversation with our pesticide working group in Annapolis, which we'll be doing very soon, we'll bring these subjects up and talk about how we view them and how they view them, since they're wrestling with our future in this agricultural committee. I want to thank Dr. Jeff Pettis for the work that he does, research leader for the USDA Agricultural Research Center's Bee Research Laboratory, co-authored the study we were talking about on honeybees, pesticides, fungicides, and crop pollination. Steve McDaniel, master beekeeper here for 35 years,
yes.
Past president of the Beekeepers Association, and who teaches a course in beekeeping at Irvine Nature Center. Mimi Thomas, director of Baltimore Honey. Thank you all so much for being
here.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Appreciate you taking the time. And thank you all for listening in here today to the Mark Steiner Show and here on Soundbites. And good to have you all with us here on Soundbites. Soundbites, of course, heard here on WEAA 88.9 FM here in Baltimore and on Salisbury on Delmarva Public Radio. That's at WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery, Stephanie Mavronis, and our engineer is Andrea Melton. And our theme music is, our engineer for Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Daniel Dupree, Alexander Rudy, and Sinead Hawkins. Theme music by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can hear the show again and podcast the show and find information about our guests and the work they do and what they've been writing at steinershow.org. And, of course, you can also listen and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.